I think Fever came in event four. Hold on. I think that was called Wonderwell. Where did you get it? That'll tell me. You didn't get that in the well, did you?
I can't remember.
That's fine. I'll find it.
I scanned event four.
The well sounds right.
Hang on. I'll look at third time's a charm, which was the last time we went downstairs.
I can't even remember. That's how old I'm getting.
Can't be that old because you're doing D&D After Dark.
I can't. D&D Donuts. When I was a kid, we would play D&D during the day, and then we'd go see a movie.
Oh, wow.
And then our DM like would start making donuts at a donut shop that he worked at about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. And so then we would go in there and basically do what we're doing right now. And then just sit there and talk about D&D. And then after about 2 hours at 3 o'clock in the morning, we would get hot fresh donuts.
That's pretty dope.
Oh yeah, that was
awesome. Looks like you got it in event two.
Oh wow, that thing's been around a while.
Hey, huh? I've had this thing forever.
Sure have.
It's getting powerful.
They've called it Flame Tongue?
Yes, it is a Flame Tongue.
Yeah. But it's also a sort of dancing, and right. It turns things to stone, and it has a wish,
and now has fire resistance. Yeah, it was.
And it has fire resistance, and it detects it traps.
Was,
or no?
It was 10K.
Yeah,
it detects gems and it identifies. This is like a couple $100,000 sword now.
Well, I think he's accidentally identifying things. So
I'm not correcting.
Right, okay, right.
Sure.
Let that roll all day long.
Yeah. See, Jim's plan was to make me miserable with the sword, but instead, what I did was embrace it. and now he has to like once you figure out that like I think what his mindset was, why would you want to share anything with the sword? But when I just said, oh, I'm going to share everything with the sword. Like, he keeps trying to make the sword more valuable by adding more abilities to the sword. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's some weird dynamic that's going on between us, but I just embraced it and said, like, oh, no, I'll dig the sword. I think Jim had the same sword when he played it, and it drove him nuts, apparently.
No, Jim played as a wizard.
Yeah, he's told me, though, he had this sword, and then after a year, he threw it away.
Oh, interesting.
He had another character. He had
He did. So Garmadged was his primary, and he had I think his ranger was his other not Pendragon. Shoot. Cannot remember. Yeah. That's a good question to ask him.
So is this podcast now happening?
Oh yeah, we've been live for 3 minutes.
So hey everybody, welcome to Late Night Donuts, Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, that's awesome.
No, I want donuts. That's mean.
I do too. I mean, after a little Thai food, that would be really nice right now. A nice like vanilla cream donut.
Either that or like you mentioned Thai massage.
Ooh.
I'm down for like Thai coffee.
Yes, Thai coffee was when I used to go to Vegas. Was my I'd hit that on the way to Vegas, and then I'd be up for a good 24 hours.
Right on.
Thai coffee, and the funny thing about Thai coffee is just Nescafe.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's not actually like coffee. It's just Nescafe and a lot of sugar and heavy cream, and then you're basically hopped up on pure like corporate caffeine and sugar.
So Felix the Swift, the one who came to with that riddle, is in the chat. He wants to know if this is the witching hour.
This is the switching hour. No, yeah, this is it, man. Thanks for showing up. Thanks for defeating Jim today. That was awesome. That's just like, it's fun because Jim's like very like, I looked up this riddle, and you almost think like, you could see Jim at a library actually looking up the riddles. Yes. And like, they'll never figure this out.
I want to know if he did it with the card catalog or if he actually got on the computer.
Yeah. Jim is a card catalog kind of guy. And just like it didn't occur to him that someone would, I'm pretty sure Rothman may have like started typing in and like typed in like, oh, okay, you know, what's that from? But you know, Riddles, I'm completely lost on Riddles. I don't get him. I don't understand him. I don't like him. So I'm glad they were big
directly from Alice in Wonderland. So that's the actual question the Hatter asks. It's the first of three, and so you know that's where it came from.
I got lucky. My nerd history degree came in for the first one because the Sumerian. That yeah. was like that's their what they're one of the things they're known for leaving behind.
I actually liked the initial at bat answer. That was pretty impressive.
I think we should have got that Ring of Wishes, but it seems like we'll be going back, so we could get the Ring of Wishes too.
I got to tell you too, the having the wishes and stuff like I mean not the wishes the riddles and stuff, if he really wanted to up his game, he could do a whole you know, from the 1964 tax code in Chicago, what is the
yeah exactly
the Chicago tax code, the answer is vote early, vote often, and bribe your way to the top.
Very good. I like that. So the chat was lit today, huh?
Oh, my God. Those guys were on fire.
Yeah. I got a bunch of messages. People were like, that was the, like, I, you know, we were posting him in the producer's channel, but, like, one guy was like, once I started listening to this, I fixed myself a drink, and this was my jam. Yeah, I'm like, that's cool. I didn't realize people would like it that much, but that's really neat.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So we... Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's blossomed into something a little more than just, you know, rolling some dice.
Yeah, and it's fun also from, like, you know, sometimes a lot of the podcasts that you can be involved in can be very, like, especially as writers, you know, you can be doing a podcast for writers, and it just becomes like, and now we're talking about writing, and we're still talking about writing, we're still talking about Successor, you know, and GE can be fun if there's something to talk about. Or just, you know, there's some good interviews or culture or whatever. But I think it's this is fun because this now almost becomes like a spectator sport for people. You know, we're not just talking about something they didn't participate in, and they're getting to participate just by listening to it happen. And then, you know, we saw some interaction where people were
bailing us out
something. Yeah, bailing us out or wanting me harmed, you know.
Okay, so So just so you don't, if you're not aware, I know who Felix the Swift is, although under pain of death, I can't tell you his name. He's like Batman. He's everyone and no one. But he made a bet where he would, if one of us were willing to throw Prometheus at the next target, he would go through their catalog and buy everything they've written. And Matthew, Michael Rothman, Levi, was like, I'm game for that. So he sent me the receipt. He went and bought all of Rothman's books today. And he's like, next session.
Sure.
So we gotta get it so like you're acrobatic and like you could like do your backstab by being thrown over them.
Yeah, what if I get killed?
Your sword won't let you die. He likes you.
I know.
Wait, is it a guy? I mean, is this crazy enough? I don't know.
So you know who Felix is?
Yes.
It's probably Josh Hayes.
That's not how you D&D, Josh. We should totally start putting those sayings on merch. Like
it's not how you D&D, Josh.
That was
or Wordna's favorite. I just am. That's like deep though.
Hagger the Horrible says, "What up, Corvette 396? Who is my brother Brian? Be wary of the underpants demon."
Your real life brother or your blood oath brother?
No, that is my real life brother.
Okay. Hi, Walt's brother.
Hey, Walt's brother. Did your brother play D&D?
He does not. He plays lots of video games and then shows up repeatedly to help me punch people in the face.
Okay, at the dojo.
Yes. Yeah.
That's how I decided to start saying dojo from now on, like a person who's never been to a dojo. At the dojo.
It used to drive me crazy. I'd walk into, there was a judo place I used to go to in Japan, and I'd only go a couple of times a week because I'm not a judoka, so I was like, whatever. And this guy would walk in, this American dude, and just the worst pronunciation ever. And it's like, yeah, I gotta go get my gi on. And I'm like, yeah, well, what part of it? You know, because saying gi is like saying sleeve. Are you gonna put them both on? Or are you gonna, you know?
Yeah.
So like, it was really, really weird. You know, like hearing like the, because I mean, for me growing up, it was getting your knuckles slapped when you mispronounce something.
Sure.
Know? So. Yeah. And I had it worse than most because my mom's side of the family is from Italy. So, you know, trying to speak Japanese was like, you know, trying to speak Martian.
Exactly. When I go to the Japanese restaurant that's run by a little Japanese family in Gran del Mar, whenever I order rice, I always summon my Imperial Warlord to say it to him. And I always go like, God! And they just die laughing. They think that's so funny.
Oh my God! So there's a guy who's a comedian in Great Britain, and he started doing this show called Uncle Roger. Have you seen this?
Uh-huh. No.
And he critiques all these foodies on YouTube who are trying to make fried rice. And he does.
Yeah. Awesome. He is so funny. He worships. What's his name now? He said
the British guy.
Yeah, we have one worthy rice maker, and he came up with nothing wrong about him. Yeah, he that was fat.
Is the guy Gordon Ramsay?
Gordon, thank you. Yeah, Gordon Ramsay, who did a great job in the interview.
And
so speaking of Gordon Ramsay, so Walt, could you take him in a cuss off?
Oh yeah, yeah, I could out cuss Gordon Ramsay.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a PhD in profanity, so. But yeah, so I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh my God, this is the most brilliant like this should be on TV. And come to find out, it's an act and the guy's like a professional comedian. <I'm> like, holy crap. Greatest thing ever. So yeah,
I love those kind of things.
Yeah, you know, because like you see the interview of the behind the scenes and it's like, hey, how's it going? My name's Martin. And you're like, wait a minute. You weren't talking like that before.
Is it make it any less funny when you know?
Now it's more funny. Because it's just brilliant. So speaking of more funny, I don't know how to perceive the whole mummy thing. Because like at the end of that adventure today, it was like the mummy was like, you know, twirling the mustache, and it's like,
yeah, I'll crank it up to 11. And you're like,
he is not going to be happy till somebody dies in this mummy pit.
Yeah, I just want to say, like, is there like a PA system in here, James? Like, you know, what?
Oh my God!
Yeah, it's did you? How did you like? Cause last week we talked about JR's Cavalier and the development of Cavaliers. And this is, you know, kind of JR's first experience playing D&D, and for a guy who's playing it for the first time ever, I think you're the highest ranking one and probably the most wealthy too, right?
No, dude. I think Werdna's a level 8. I'm a level 7. It just the Cavalier packs a lot bigger punch. Yeah. So I'm essentially punching above my weight class, so to speak.
You're doing great. Like I'm literally, I think I'm probably the best player here with the most brilliant ideas and the daring. And I'm literally like fifth and fourth level. So you're doing great.
So they like the back and forth between the two of us, apparently.
Yeah.
I was trying to trick you to go first. I'm like, there's no need for bravery if there's nothing wrong, if there's no danger.
You can't trick me. See, the Cavalier and the Paladin, like, it's mainly the Cavalier. Like, it's just such, and the Barbarian's a little this way, too. But it's, there's, you have such an easy lever to pull, which is, and that's, you know, and James is watching. He already told me, he's like, I'm glad that you said that to him because he does need to do more Cavalier stuff. And like, the Cavalier can't look bad, you know, like, so you do have to be that guy that's at the front of the tip of the spear. Me, I'm just a lowly knave.
So Felix the Swift says Nick is the king of YOLO.
That's true. I am the king of YOLO.
You should get that on a t-shirt.
The king of YOLO, Prometheus Actual, or Chaos Actual, the king of YOLO.
Oh man, my God. Great. Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah, that could be a cool. Put that with the logo on the back. Yeah, that could be cool.
Yeah, exactly. And Walt's cleric is coming along, kind of developing. You've settled on a religion now. You're gonna build it. What is your whole monastery, or what James kind of gave you?
Oh, I was hoping to do not like so much a monastery as in like, you know, the Monty Python guys walking around hitting themselves with boards and, you know, all that garbage. I was thinking more like a Knights Templar, you know, like fortress. You know, because I mean, to me, that's what the clerics are. I mean, there's this Knight Templar, like you read into those like old histories, and the Knights Templar, they were really vicious guys, because I mean, they were in charge of like, you know, keeping the war money going, and then you had like the Knights Hospitaller, which were like European Valkyries, pretty much. I mean, it was crazy the amount of like how vicious these people are. And then you get like, you know, here comes, you know, Gary Gygax in his very popular game, and it's like, they don't use these weapons, and they never shed blood. It's like, dude, did you read a history book?
Yeah. They cannot draw blood. They may never use edged weapons.
Use edged weapons.
And even though they're in full armor and everything, they fight like a thief. And you're like, yeah. So, like, I mean, and we discussed that last week. We were like, oh, basically, they should have made the paladin the cleric. And then that would have been pretty cool. But you should find, like, when you have to clear for your sort of, like, your feudal fortress, you should find, like, the worst, most inhospitable, like, rock. Like, out in the middle of a wasteland.
So, basically, Alcatraz.
Yeah, but like, you know, kind of like along a trade route or a little bit from the city, and then just build like a big block of a fortress. It's just like ugly, you know, and like, and just brutal, and put dungeons down there. But, you know, what the knights were a lot of times is they were actually bankers too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So like, just make it like a vault. That'd be cool.
Yeah. The,
so what would the, they were in, when you started talking about temples, somebody in the chat mentioned the Polish hussars.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what would that be, closer to a paladin, do you think, or a cavalier, or what?
The hussars are definitely cavaliers.
Yeah. And I had a Polish hot dog this week. It was great.
You know, you mentioned this on the stream, so you got to elaborate a little bit.
So Doc Spears and I went out to a military museum with his two sons, and we spent the day doing that. And there's a neighborhood, you know, kind of situated between here and there called Santa Ana. And Santa Ana is a little rough. And normally my only wingman is whatever weapon I'm carrying and Nicole. And Nicole's not a great wingman for Santa Ana. But since I had this actual special operator with me, I was all hot dog time. So I said, you know, John, keep your head on a swivel. This neighborhood's a little dangerous. But, you know, John did not fear. And so we went in, and I've been following, you can follow them on Instagram. It's called Verst House. And they had like, I got a Polish dog with sauteed jalapenos, which is a very California thing, drunken onions and sauerkraut on a pretzel roll that was soft and sweet, but then like rubbed with butter on the outside and put on flames so it was crispy. Oh, and then I think I got like duck fat fries too. It was just glorious. It was so good.
That sounds
so that's
amazing.
Where somewhere between Reno and Rome is?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The somewhere between Reno and Rome burger is elusive right now, but I am actually like on a little burger hunt right now, because I like at the end of the day, I'll just go to In-N-Out Burger because that's probably my favorite burger. But I do like to find like the really good diner roadside burger. So I do need to find that, you know, if not, or just make it myself. So yeah, Andrew, like, you've been developing your wizard. Tell us about that. And you know, how you're shaping this character.
Well, primarily I've been putting my time into making him sort of a spell machine. The idea behind this wizard is more of a useful compatriot, since we are predilected by being a combat unit. I've added a lot of supplemental spells to facilitate enabling you all with abilities. The first one being elemental blade, which allows me to transform the weapons you all carry into one of the elements to give it more power. My newest spell, Cloak, will enhance invisibility to add silence and remove smell. So as I'm supplementing...
So when you're saying you're creating these spells, are you creating them, or are you combing old... Like, are you just making it up and saying, like,
no, I'm
this actually, would be a great idea for a spell?
So I'm actually building them from scratch.
Okay. Because there's, like, a lot of old dragon articles that have, like, a lot of really great...
And yeah. I've got them all. That's the beauty. I was a subscriber from some of the very earliest issues and own all the issues of Dragon and Dungeon. But
have you ever had this happen? You swear there was an article and you can't find it.
Sure. Yeah. There's some levels of paranoia in trying to find out what's mixed up in your head and what's not. But I'm lucky in that our club... one of my requirements is spellcasters have to demonstrate proficiency. And that means for each what we call circle of spell ability, they have to generate one unique spell that they create personally. So it's sort of SOP in our club for all the guild's spellcasters to generate spells. So I'm used to it and know how to make them pretty well. And it's fun.
You know what spell I would create?
What do you got?
Create hot dogs. Summon Timusus. Ooh,
mm-hmm.
That'd be great.
Yeah, hey,
great.
Have you been to New York and stuff like that?
I lived in New York. Yeah, I lived in Park Slope.
So, you've obviously had a Coney Island hot dog.
No, I didn't. I would go to Gray's Papaya though a lot.
Okay, so yeah. But you've seen a Coney Island hot dog before.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So in Rhode Island, where I live, we have this type of hot dog, and immediately, if he's still in the chat, Corvette 396 is going to know exactly what I'm talking about, because we were just talking about this before the show. We have an illegal hot dog called the Hot Weenie.
Yeah.
And the reason they're illegal is because he just came in the chat. He's like,
you just cast summon hot dog lover.
Yep. So they're affectionately known as gaggers.
That's a selling point.
The reason they're illegal in most states.
JR, I've always found it to be.
He's auditioning to be a Cap Scout.
Yeah. The reason that they're illegal, though, is just because of a red dye that's not approved by the FDA.
Yeah.
But they're amazing. It's basically a Coney Island hot dog with celery salt, chopped onions, and hamburger with a little bit of mustard.
So in the other parts of New York, those are called dirty dogs.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the term. All now, there's a confusion between upstate and western New York. But if you're heading toward Glens Falls from the Albany area, all those places on the water, from anywhere from the track on up, that's just known as the dirty dog. And that's a standard. Really good onions, a hamburger.
Oh, yeah.
They're ketchup free. That's not a ketchup dog, but
I've got to go be alone in JR's bunk with that.
So you'll get a kick out of this, Andrew. So we have Felix the Swift saying Werdna carrying the team single-handedly.
Pretty much, yeah. I think that became evident the first sort of like the first time we went in, and you were, you know, I think like because we'd been adventuring with Jim through Metamorphosis Alpha. And stuff like that, and we knew that there were going to be a lot more traps here and stuff like that. And sometimes it's kind of hard to tell, you know, what to do with Jim's traps or anything like that. But I think once we saw you kind of going through like, okay, I do this with the smoke and I do this thing and the sand and everything like that, and then it became apparent that you could kind of solve Jim's traps that way. That definitely upped our game.
Well, it's interesting. I will say he truly, truly does remember, and obviously much more of the Gary-esque flavor of Greyhawk. It it is a brutal place. I find it interesting to stumble into places that I have a hazy 45-year-old memory of.
Yeah.
So Remembering that there were three towers, remembering certain rooms, and it's interesting that on occasion I have dreams that we are then able to translate into useful actions. So I think this was an actual place, but I can't remember. Like, I'm convinced there's a room with clowns. I have a clown statues or clown wooden idols, something, and they are fantastic and terrible. There's ways to raise and lower ability scores, and I remember us stumbling into a bunch of clown statues, and if you touch the wrong one or look at the wrong one or talk to the wrong one or fight the wrong one, it screws with your scores. But there's something you can do that's associated with clowns that provides super benefits. I just don't remember what it is. I mean, I was at the time 10 years old, so.
Yeah. What was your favorite module? What was the module that you played? And I'm saying specifically module now, that you played when you were a kid that made the biggest impact on you.
Caverns of Thracia. So
Janelle, that's so weird that you're going to say that. That is my module too.
So that is our. So we inaugurate members into the club through what's called COT, Caverns of Thracia, and that.
Yeah.
We located that on the map on Greyhawk. For us, that's called the second sphere of Multi, and we stuck Caverns of Thracia in the far east portion in the Forgotten Jungle area, and it's just a fantastic thing. I've been pestering her for years to cough up a drawing of the Immortal King. I even offered to pay the commission on it, and she just said doesn't have the bandwidth for it. But
yeah, that is so weird that you're going to say that, because that I was like, oh, and I know what I'll say Caverns of Thracia, and everybody like, oh yeah.
But well, that and Dark Tower are really my favorite two judges guilds other than City State. The Invincible Overlord has great components. I just didn't get to play very long because by 78 I was pretty much, I still played during that 1 year, but I also took over as DM, and so our campaign has been my world, you know, really starting in 76, but really since 78 on, I have run the show. On Tuesday, we rolled up our 3,000th character. So.
Oh, wow. Wow. And Walt, what was your favorite module as a kid?
Ooh, White Plume Mountain.
Ooh.
Yeah. Why? Because... Yes. Because you wanted to get Black Razor.
No, I didn't want Black Razor. I didn't want any of them, actually. It was more the fact that when we sat down to play it, it was the GM said, "This is the most deadly module ever. You will never walk out of here with these weapons." And I'm like, I bet you we can walk out of here with these weapons. So... and it was more along the lines of, watching my grandparents and members of my family and how they dealt with people in the real world, as far as like business negotiations. And I'm like, look, tomorrow when we go into White Plume Mountain, when you're running White Plume Mountain again, can you tone down this particular area? And dude, I'll buy you lunch.
You learned how the world worked.
And I was like, wow, you know, this module isn't as hard as, you know, as it could be, because, you know, my grandfather was right, and he said, you know, you could tell people you're just going to give them money to do things, and they'll turn you down, but if you tell them you'll do things for them, a lot of times they'll warm up to you. And I'm just like, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, don't give somebody $5 to do what you want. Buy them lunch. Make it a social affair.
Yes.
And I'm like,
that's true.
Huh. Sure enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I just had that experience at the range. I had my armor working on my M1. And I could tell that he was like, I got to go to lunch. I'm like, hey, I'm going to lay $40 on you for your lunch today. Is that cool? And I'll pay your armor rate too. And he's like, oh no, $40 for lunch is great, thanks. Like, lunch was more important to him than the $40, than, you know, his armor, right? So yeah, I totally. And JR, the only module you ever played in, you got kicked out of for being a right-wing bigot, right?
Yeah, but the right-wing people blame me for everything too as a libertarian, because I'm the cause of all their woes as well. Everybody hates you when you don't conform.
You're a Quisling, you know what I mean? You can't commit, so that's okay. We love you.
I'm a milquetoast fence sitter, I guess, although that's somebody else's line.
No, it's a yeah. So, you know, I think
and I did kinda... I was gonna say I did the Adventurers League with the local game shop. But that was just too, I don't know, we talked about this before, but it was too restricting on what they would and wouldn't let you do. So you couldn't really play your characters, and class almost meant nothing.
Yeah.
And that just wasn't fun. I mean,
you shouldn't play D&D with anybody whose prefrontal lobe is not developed in this day and age. That's just, like, it may have been fun way back in the day when we're all, let's die. I remember this one kid walked into our game shop, and he was annoying as all hell. And by the end, he was a dwarf. And by the end of it, we had dyed him blue and left, like, turned him into a smurf. And like took all his clothing and like kicked him out of the dungeon naked, and you know that's you know Lord of the that back in the days it was Lord of the Flies fun. You could be completely inappropriate, but like I can't even imagine what it's like to walk into a game shop now and play and not offend somebody, or you know like want to do the things the trouble that you just do get up to playing a game, which can derail the whole thing and everything like that. But when you have these codes of standards or things that people have to abide by or whatever, like, you don't need that in your life. Just walk away. Have fun. I think James would let us do anything we wanted to do right now. And that's half the fun.
Yeah. He pushes back appropriately, I think.
Well, we're also pushing the envelope on him in that he is getting a chance to sort of exercise his campaign muscle now. And I think that it's really fun to watch his creativity go. I mean, he calls me all the time about, you know, that he's working direction, and he works this hard. He is mapping and changing stuff. And so it's good. It's really good for him.
No, it's really growing a very living ecology. I had a little, a week and a half ago, because I'm multi-class, you know, I play Prometheus, who's the fighter thief, people who are listening. And I said, James, you deducted two of my levels. And if I have to play two more sessions, I'm going to really fall behind. Can I just like do a catch-up session with him? He's like, okay, the Thieves Guild has a mission for you. And he starts going into this whole thing about the Crimson Hawk Cemetery and all the things that are going on there. And it got really involved and really fun. And then Walt accidentally caught us cheating. And Walt jumped in and we had a lot of fun in the cemetery. And so, you know, like, it's really becoming, you know, now he's got JR clearing for a pavilion. Walt's going to make a crusader fortress. And
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
That sage, though, that I've been working with, who got killed, when I said I hired him to look into the Black Tower, where we saw the dragon on top of the tower, and he said, yeah, there's orcs and a warlord there, and your sage is dead, and they carved an R in his chest. So, like, that definitely tells me, like, he's developing stuff. It's not, I think the Gygaxian dungeon is like, hey, here's a beholder, and now here's some orcs who live right next door to the beholder, and you're like, and what's the reason for that? And he's like, there's no reason. I just need to test these things.
So we have Felix the Swift says he wants to watch those streams where you're doing the little mini sessions. And he said that when I said I was, you know, it's a libertarian, the most hated, he said that basically I can't claim Canadian status. They're the most hated.
It's true.
I've got the event sheet completed now, so I'm going to do the totals. Who wound up with the Scarab of the Insect?
I did, and I put it on, and bad things happened.
No, that was the Ring of Water. I thought you got the Ring of Water Walking.
The Scarab went to, that had to have gone to Levi then.
Levi did get it, okay.
Yeah, because he didn't want the new Water Walking Ring.
Right.
Because it was, so he switched.
Got it. That's all I needed to know to confirm.
Should we tell people what happened when I put the ring on, or do we keep that?
I don't know what happened because I had to leave.
Oh my God, you got to tell him.
He said, you don't get the XP until you put the ring on. Are you going to put the ring on, JR? And I'm like, Leroy Jenkins. Yes, I'll put the ring on. It's great. Now you're naked and afraid. You've just turned into a werewolf. I'm like, oh, I just paid 3,000 gold for that full Anubis plate. Luckily, he's done the naked and afraid thing before, so yeah. I didn't get rid of when I upgraded my plate. I still have another full set in the hotel, a full plate.
Well, I don't understand what happened to your plate.
I metamorphosized into a werewolf.
Maybe the plate can be repaired.
Oh, it can. I'll retrieve it.
Well, he had said something about Wald was like, oh, so he's naked and afraid again, huh? And James was like, yep. So I'm counting on it being a loss, but you know.
No, it's not. So transformation, you shed your stuff and run. So we'll just take it back. That's fine. I've got the other backpack of holding, so we'll just pack it and go.
Yeah. So, but yeah, they did like the idea of some of those little mini sessions, recording those too.
Yeah.
From the stream. Will.
Yeah, well, so. I think what we're developing now is, we might switch to kind of like a new broadcasting thing. I mean, not like a new way that we produce the show by using, you know, stuff I don't know anything about. And so we were thinking about doing a mini session this week that we would broadcast on Twitch. And I'm kind of like, a good thing we could discuss right now is like everything that we've seen and where we might like to go, on that mini session that I had, the sage told me, hey, you know, there's some doings in the Crimson Hawk graveyard. And he said, there's rumors that there's a big underground area underneath the graveyard. And the Thieves Guild was who sent me to the oldest sort of a mausoleum, in the cemetery. And it's at the very center of it. And there's a paladin under there, and he had bracers and a hammer. And so I grabbed the hammer and took off as this sort of like Death Knight paladin woke up and came after me. And he was a paladin of like, he mentioned the deity. It was like Cromarg or something like that. And it was like super old. And he gave away a few things. He's like, this paladin has like 100 hit points. You should run. But then he was also like, he burned up in sunlight because he got in a little sunlight. So what I was thinking was, well, I was like, hey, let's go get a bunch of mirrors and direct the sun down into the tomb and then crack the tomb and then flood it with sunlight and burn him up and we can take his stuff. I just need the bracers to complete my quest. But he did have like a fantastic helm. He had a really great sword, like a big flaming sword, a two-handed sword, JR, that you would want. And then he had like a bag of gems that was supposed to be really good.
Cool.
Yeah.
So
that's one area we could go to, or we could go back and try to get the items, the rest of the items that we got today. And then there's the room to our right, and then wipe out the Sun Pharaoh. Or we could go back into the elf dungeon, or we could deal with those trolls because that's going to continue to cost us money.
Yeah. So I was thinking is what I was proposing at the end. If he's got this underground or this basement level, the innkeeper, because it's the other thing, the innkeepers had to kill a lot of people that keep trying to rob us, so he wanted to kick us out. When we got back after the session, because this wasn't live, our stuff was in the street. It's like he was divorcing us, this innkeeper. And so I thought about maybe just outright buying the basement level, sort of like a condo for us, and then we don't have to rent it.
Why don't we just buy the whole tavern?
I don't think we have to loot for that yet. And we've got to pay for Andrew's spells.
Oh, okay.
Well, so, I'm able to cover them right now. We are accumulating that pool of community money. So far, I've been able to use my own cash and selling other stuff that I'm doing for work. So we're doing okay right now.
Cool. So this is a little bit of a throwback question for you, Andrew, but what was the dice situation when you first started gaming back in 76? Like all these fancy-sided dice, was that all already around, or did that sort of develop for the game?
So the challenge at the older times was the dice were produced only by that education company, and so they were very cheap polyhedrons, And they came in two types depending on where you got them. Normally you could get a set of five of the original dice, and those are the ones, it's the white 20-sided, the blue 12-sided, the orange 6-sided, the green 8-sided, and the yellow 4-sided. And then the blue and red box offered a white 20-sided and also a pink one. And really they were just 10-sided dice, and you took a marker and colored one side or colored in or used your armory crayons and marked up the characters. The really strong polyhedron plastic extruded dice like Chessex makes and some of the others, those started showing up in the early 80s along with what at the time was called crystal dice, all the different transparent dice. And then in the late 80s, metal dice started to make a showing. But Gary had, and he carried, his own set of handmade metal dice with him in his pocket. And when I beat him in that game, he gave me his 6-sided die that was the handmade metal die.
Nice. Have you tested the weight? Does it roll true, or is it...
Oh, it's heavy as hell. So look at it. You can see that the pips on it are not straight.
Oh, that's dope.
Wow.
See how that is? And so this was very bright gold, but it was beat to hell. And when I brought it, I was invited by Luke to come and, you know, share the story of how I won this die. And when I took it out, Ernie walked right over and said, "Oh, my God. You know, I remember these as a child, and where did this come from?" So I said, "Well, I don't know how your brother heard the story, but, you know, I wrote it." So it was kind of fun.
Cool.
All right.
That's pretty cool.
So, yeah, like, let's see your beholder. Let's see your beholder, Walt.
He's coming along.
It's getting there.
Ooh, he's scary.
I got to put a few.
He's
more
like a he's like a devil beholder,
right? Yeah, I know. I never liked the big fat beholder that was kind of like the what do you call it? Like the goofy one.
Oh, the medicine beholder.
Yeah, he was just like, you know, and he had the open mouth that just didn't seem like it was very scary. I mean, the first time I ever faced a beholder was like, God, I mean, just scores of men just dying. And you're just like, what the shit is this? This sucks.
So we could go whale on that beholder. I'm thinking that, like, we should throw James a curveball. Because if we say we're going back to the Pharaoh place, like, he's going to spend the week basically just amping it up to smoke us. But if we throw him a curveball, like, we're going to go whale on that beholder. We have, like, a plan. Or the trolls, or like something he hasn't considered. Then
there's that then, that gem over in the well.
The one,
a petrification gem.
Oh, the one you lost.
Yeah, the one that's in the hand of a petrified.
Right, that's where the beholder is.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I can now deal with the beholder, and I can deal with the cockatrices. So I have found a magical solution. So
what about the shamans?
How could you deal with the beholder?
I have a variant on gaze reflection, and so his gaze attacks will not work on me, and I can actually return them back. So we can get.
And so, what would happen if I hit him with fever, who I can ask to turn something to stone?
He has anti-magic shell, so
right.
Most functions from the sword won't affect him,
okay.
Unless he directs them at us first. So I think what we want to do is use my new spell cloak and supplement that with my invisibility 10-foot radius so we won't be seen, heard, or smelled in any way, and we can put a big surprise down on something that is a killing machine.
Yeah, because those things are nasty.
All right. They have 11
plus
a bite.
How would we fight it? Like, what would we do?
So our primary function would be to use some of our massive distance effects, use my globe of invulnerability to shut down his anti-magic shell, gaze reflection so that he stuffs his own spells into his face, and then nuke him, do hardcore damage.
from surprise. So I would make you all invisible and cloaked, put you on the other side, reveal myself, let him gaze all he wants and reflect those, and then attack him with my distance spells while you all did heavy face-to-face, corpse-to-corpse damage.
So then my sword would work once we shut down the Zanday magic shell.
Exactly right.
We would and I could just hit him once and turn him to stone.
Well, yes. I think his saving throw is phenomenal. I'll tell you what it is. So he needs a 5. So that's not bad. But I mean, it's doable. And I would rather we didn't turn him to stone because I want to harvest him for parts. Well, I'm getting ready to start. I'm one level away from being able to do potions and scrolls. And once I can start cranking out our own potions and scrolls, we can really start getting our hands on a lot more reinforcements and armaments to allow some of our, you guys who are non-spellcasters, to really add some juice to your arsenal.
So that's an option. So what about the trolls? How could we deal with the trolls? I think James has given away that there are 4 two-headed trolls.
Yeah, so those are a form of giant troll. They regenerate twice as powerfully as a regular troll. That means they are, you know, between their size and their hitting capability. So a troll will get a lot of attacks around, and they can be decapitated and dismembered. It would be interesting to see if he's given them a fire resistance. To counter that, I took some serious ice spells as well. And what I would suggest is we first recon them. Now that we have cloak, we can go in and wander around ethereally as wraith form and check them all out, get map out the area, and then lay out some traps and old school deadfalls and lure them in and bust them up.
Yeah. Okay. So there's that. And then what about the paladin and the crypt? How could we handle that?
So a paladin is a very interesting thing. The question is, did he reverse the class on it, or is it truly a paladin?
If it is, he said it was a paladin that has been dead.
Okay. So a dead paladin can be... Now, is it something you want to kill to take his stuff?
Well, I'm supposed to get some bracers he has on him.
Okay. So...
Well, and he said he has like 100 hit points.
So, all right, so I would say we could do 2 things. The first is we could probably, if he's undead, we could probably immobilize him with a very nasty undead spell I have that would cause him humongous damage. The other option is through scrying, we might be able to do a hold undead spell on him and allow you guys to go to town on damage.
Yeah, that could be cool. So I think those options, I mean, that beholder does sound like any mistake, and Jim is, you know, he's going to exploit a mistake and then and kill us. So
punish us.
You know, yeah.
So, well, yeah, that's fun as giving us a major beatdown. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I would say let's try to figure out something besides running back to my, I mean, we can still explore. He did remark. He's like, oh, you know, you guys are ready for the third level now on these towers. So we could do that, but I think what are our concerns right now? We kind of need more magic items and we need more money.
So we are on the edge of being able to now build out infrastructure. And so as we start thinking about that, so so the base experience points for everyone will be 8,100. That's before all the magic and individual awards. But the base is 8,100. And then for the 10 percenters, that translates to 8,910. So I think we'll find that people have done pretty well based on all what the magic items were worth. And I'm not exactly sure yet, but we've got a ton of things that he said I should try and cash in with the Black Wizard. So we'll see what the Black Wizard wants to give us for the chariot, for the 2 rings of nasty transformation. So
we don't want to keep the chariot to ride into battle?
No.
It's gold.
So it's cursed. So that means you would save every time you used it. That just seems hard to deal with. I mean, we could kill that magic, but that would be more than magic, which would be temporary at best.
What magic items did we distribute?
So the magic items we got we haven't distributed this one. So we have Trickster, the other longsword. We have Drawn's Warhammer. The Gem of Fire Resistance went to Fever. The Ring of Water Walking and Lycanthropy. The Scarab of the Insect. And additionally, we have several other magic items. We have the Sapphire Ring of Transformation, the Star Ruby Ring of Transformation. Both of those are negative. The Black Opal, which is cursed as well, and the Teak Box. So
it seems like we got a lot of, because the hammer is bad too.
Well, no, the hammer is actually good. So the two things, here's the book. It has benefits and minuses. The biggest benefit to the hammer is it does more than a Warhammer's regular damage. A D10 is fantastic, plus 8. That's humongous.
Yeah.
Your starting point, it's doing a minimum of 9 to 18 all day long. It's plus to hit is bad. It's a minus to hit, but who cares? So, I mean, you're doing plow shear damage, which is awesome.
So, Walt, how close are you to your temple?
What do you mean?
The gold, I think, was yours is pretty pricey too, right?
Yeah, well, the thing is, I don't need. I can initially build, because I don't have to build a straight temple. I can build a barracks, you know, and use it as a templar fort as long as there's a place of worship in it.
So, well, wasn't there a gold value that he gave you?
Well, no, I got the gold value from the castle handbook from the old second edition. So there's like a whole handbook about building strongholds and fortresses and stuff. So it would take about a month's time, and it would cost roughly 32,000 to what do you call it, build that fortress.
So he quoted me 58,000 gold to build the temple. I guess I got to buy the slaves to build the pyramid. I don't know.
Nice.
I've got that whittled down to 44,800 roughly. Because I've just been donating all of my gold that Andrew wouldn't take to the temple fund.
Gotcha.
So maybe in a couple months we'll have that.
So wait. So you need to build a Crusader barracks, right?
Yes, eventually, at some
point. And JR needs to build a pavilion for what?
Temple to Anubis. He didn't specify, so I don't know how much autonomy he gives us on what we build. Traditionally, Egyptians, since it's Egyptian gods, built pyramids for their temples. But I mean, we could deviate.
Well, no, the temple could also be. So remember, the Egyptians had a pretty heavy Romanesque influence. So they also do open air pavilions. You have a lot of choices on building types that you can do, because your god is an outdoor and underground god. You could have like a small spilture or a small crypt type area, you know, just an underground area. You could do a lot that could make a pretty impressive fortress. So there's some options we have. I've been thinking about it. As soon as you gain a level, so we've got to preserve your herald at all costs, because you are one follower away from gaining your fifth level follower. And that guy will be a major butt kicker. So he comes with magic items. Yeah, that's a plus 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 for you.
So why does JR have to build a pavilion? What is that for?
That's just the cavalier is a religious follower of Anubis, so that was my task from Anubis, from the temple.
So you have to build the temple and the pavilion.
No, he said specifically, he called it a temple. They are pointing out in the chat, Felix the Swift is saying that pyramids are actually tombs and temples were other structures. So, but James said a temple.
Yeah, that's right.
So what I'm
thinking though is why don't we build Walt's structure, your structure side by side, and then we only have to clear one area. Or does Walt act? Wasn't there something about you have to go into the hills and build it, right?
I think that was just him joking.
No, I was talking about when I was initially positing it, I was going to put it on like the what do you call it, like on a trade road, so that way people it could be a waypoint for people to visit, And the reason I was saying put it up in the mountains is because there's always somebody getting lost up there, you know. So these soldiers would always have tasks that would allow them to soldier. And at the same time, putting it along a trade route would guarantee, you know, when you have like a trade caravan coming through, just knock those people with like a yeah, you come in here and stay for the night, but you got to pay for food, you got to pay for lodging for your horses, and you got to pay for, you know, you got to pay for what do you call it? You got to pay for the protection of the temple. You got to donate, you know. So then a big portion of that goes to the upkeep of, you know, the temple, the barracks, the whatever, and then a small portion of that goes to us, which we can then fund into. My plan was to have it fund into Werdna so that he could have more money for research and stuff like that. And
Well, I'm just
oh, the
about
other, go ahead.
doing big spells. So as I start so doing fourth circle spells is going to be 8 grand a pop. So I'm yeah, the any money supply we start going, and I don't mind being perpetually broke. That's working out. What I am doing is saving my largest gems so that I can create ion stones, which
Dear
could be
Lord.
serious juice. So I've been hoarding away. I'm just selling off everything I have and using the dragon's poison and a couple of blood combination things I made and all sorts of crazy stuff just to you know, flex Jim's mental muscle, as well as coming up with schemes on how to get. I mean, I have 5 custom spells built right now, and I've got another 5 in the pipe.
So I was actually so when I had to design 19 retainers, for the Cavalier, and so when I designed all of them, I gave them for the non-weapons proficiencies, the bower fletcher one, the armorer one, and the weaponsmith. So I was thinking once we set the pavilion up and we had the structure that was we could call our own, we could start, you know, one, repairing our own kit, and then potentially put in some competition to the in-town businesses for the three.
Well, the key there is you're going to want to offer that service to a group that we can gain a favorable reaction to, so that you'll be able to recruit more men at arms. Because there are several different types of followers. There are the ones you attract, those are the ones you have so far. There are men at arms that you can recruit at usually a 1-to-1 ratio, money to time. And then you can also hire mercenaries, which I think is our last resort. That's the most expensive resource. But the benefit for you is once your army gets to be of a certain size, you'll continue to attract higher level profiles that can be used to leverage and use some of these non-weapon proficiencies in a retail fashion from wherever your pavilion or temple is laid out.
Yeah, and I just want to see what the Cavalier could do on a horseback. I mean, I got 19 people. I'd like a cavalry charge just to see what that's like.
And I think you're going to get that. The only problem of trying to start a business and then using your frontline troops as that fodder is Jim will mow them down like summer wheat. So,
Yeah, I spent a lot of gold outfitting Andine, and they killed her in one session.
yeah, right. Well, and that follows the Gygaxian rule of don't bring the dog.
Yeah, he killed the dog too. Poor Reaper.
Well, right. It's tough. I'm very careful with Razor only because I know how persnickety he can be with his power set. So I'm very careful with that being only because at the moment its death would be my death simultaneous. I could not survive its death.
Could you grow to the point where that's not true?
Yes. But so for example, by next level, I will be able to survive, but I would have maybe 2 or 3 hit points, so I'd be basically only good for being a sage. Couldn't be an adventurer anymore.
The cool thing
So
about the cap.
what would happen if I use the wish for like the most expensive gem in the world? I wish for the most expensive gem in the world.
So what that's going to do is it's going to do one of two things. It's either going to call attention to an artifact gem that will either A, actively resist you, or B, in the possession of something powerful, or it would be the location of such. So it wouldn't bring it to you, it would give you, all of the information, basically divining its location.
Okay. We built a bit, or like, what if we had a big room, and like the basement that JR was talking about, and I said, I wish this room were filled with gold coins.
So I can tell you, having been schooled in Gary's form of wishology, the twists and turns, the simpler, and then the more linguistic that is.
It's looking good.
So we're going to have to use specific and deliberate language that is absolute in interpretation. The key is, for every notation that we have that's derivative in language, the best thing about this being a group of authors, we'll have a very good understanding of the prose necessary to build it out, and I know the formatting. I would say our homework for this week is to decide what we actually care about. We don't need money. We really need to decide on, are we trying to build infrastructure? Do we want a location? Or what is it that will help the party grow, if you want to use this wish as a party thing? If you would prefer to use it to accompany or outfit yourself, that's fine too. It's yours.
No. I'd like to use it to finance us or get us something, you know, that will help us. The party is contributing to the sword as an NPC. You know, like that's the point that I was making, is like, you know, yeah, I know I'm taking expensive stuff for it, but it's vampiring me. It's retarding my growth. But at the same time, I do know that the gems help me as a player character. But, you know, like I'm lagging behind, and that could get me killed as we go into rougher areas.
Well, yeah, and that's the biggest noticeable thing that will happen as we start to level dive, is the disparity in levels is where it'll bite hard, because the volume of saving throws will increase, the volume of higher end effects will increase, and those of us with lower hit points will be consumed just by being in the spaces. So hit points become the name of the game, as well as stronger saving throws. So finding protection items has been very laxical so far. We haven't had lackadaisical, I think was the word I was thinking of. We haven't had almost any protection items, and those are the things we really are going to need to be able to take on monsters and have armor classes that make us harder to hit. So that's stuff that's
coming. What if I said this? I wish for the two-headed trolls that live in this cave, we do the recon, to be on fire with Greek fire for 3 hours straight.
So wishing to kill something is... So anytime you're wishing for something that comes with a variable outcome, your chance of success is infinitesimal. I think we will be better served by using the wish to have access to a land grant, to gain nobility status. I think we want to use a wish to influence our direct relationship to the game, because that's not a variable that comes with a lot of multiplicative outcomes. I think we'll gain the most advantage that way.
Yeah.
And hard to do. Getting noble status, hard to do.
What does that do for us?
Well, so noble status opens doors. It allows us the actual ability to buy land. Whereas if we can find a plot that we like and we can generate a great wish, we will then have the land and the clearing will be fine. So half the fun for Jim is figuring out the bait and switch, meaning we go through the motions of clearing the land, we knock out the orcs, we kill the giants, we kick over the skeletons, we do all the things necessary. We get to the land and we clear it, and then some other guy rides up and says, hey, thanks for doing that for me. I really needed that. And my troops are going to start doing their deployments here. What? So we want to leverage, I think, the wish, which can alter the reality for the better. Affecting the trolls or a monster, that's a situational event that we can do under our own intelligence. I think the wish is best spent as an object that is used to influence our direct benefit under a permanent situation. It's a thought.
Yeah. It's a good thought, but we should kind of figure out what we're going to do next week to address these issues.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Like stabbing stuff.
So, speaking of next week, when you did the notes this week, did you already take out the tax for the party?
No, I didn't, because I don't know that we've set a fixed number.
Okay.
You know,
did we get any money?
Yes. So we have a group money total of 25,000 GP.
Ooh.
And so that translates individually to 4,167. So everyone got 1,833 for Monster, 4,167 for money, and a full party bonus individually of 2,100. So per person, it was 8,100 total before magic items, and then the magic grants to specific individuals. Now, nobody is assigned to the sword I've designated as Trickster for its name, and that's 10 grand. So
which one is that?
That's the long sword that detects traps.
Oh, Walt, I've got to deduct it, but there was a trade had with Richard for that. That's how we got it in a way that Jim would approve. So a portion of my gold will go to his temple.
Okay, yeah, and that's fine.
I'm okay with giving it where it will be used. I mean, I've already got the blade for Anubis, but...
Well, I would... are you also proficient in longsword?
No, I have the Kopesh, the Horseman's Flail, and the Lance.
Right, but
It is a proficiency. It's not a weapon of choice.
Yeah, which is fine. So as a proficient weapon, you can use it because it's a magic sword, so it's got a plus to hit. We just don't know what that is yet. I'll identify it this week and find that out. Walt, you should also name your Warhammer.
Dave.
That's what
What's that?
Dave, I'll just put that in if that's what you want.
No, I don't know what I'll do yet. I'll make
Skull Splitter.
Nah, you could go with something more. See, I don't know. Let's put it to Felix. So far he's been trying to name the party. Felix the Swift. He's come up with the Nefarious Exodus, the Sacred Crusaders, the Cruel Crew, the Gentle Force. The Discarded Coalition, the Party Name Generator, the Silver Vanguard.
As a placeholder, I call us Revelry for now. That's what I call us. Magical Mayhem is what that means. So that's what I call us as a placeholder. It can be changed to anything, but that's when you see that in notes.
Because this leads to sort of the... You know, Walt, you said that people were always already asking for subscriptions.
Yes.
And so what does that mean?
So on Twitch, when they start saying that you can have people support you and support what you're doing, there's two ways that they can do that right now. One is by subscription and one is by donation. So donation, they buy bits of digital currency for a certain amount. You get a certain amount of these bits, and you can pass them out to people, you know, to get emojis and highlighted text so you can have questions or you know, give like a hell yeah. And then the other way to support a channel is by subscription. And it's basically like a Netflix subscription to that one channel. Now, even though watching the channel is free, you just go to the channel, whatever, you're basically donating a dedicated amount per month on a subscription basis for X number of months, so that it you get like custom status in the channel, you get all your texts are highlighted and stuff like that, and you know, you get certain facets and abilities because you've subscribed.
Okay, so I mean, like the fun thing to do, as we noticed today, would be to involve people in situations where they can participate, not throwing Prometheus into stuff. But I guess if that's what they want to do, that's what they want to do.
I was dying. I'm like, what?
I guess what we could do with this is we could say, okay, Do we get to do subscriptions next week, or are we still a bit of ways away from it?
We're after this broadcast, we need one more show in order to get subscriptions.
Okay, so let's see if we can do a midweek show, if that's cool. Like, I don't know if what your bandwidth is, but maybe we can do a, yeah, let's like do an afternoon micro show, and let's go down and try to wipe out that paladin, just the four of us, and then that'll be our show, and we'll post that or pop that up, and then if we can do subscriptions on Friday, what we say is, okay, we need to really name this group, so the first 10 people to subscribe will get to, each of them will get to pick a name for us, and then we'll put it to a general vote the week after.
There you go.
So like, you know, like, or we don't even say the first 10 people, everybody who subscribes today gets to come up with a name that will be voted on in the next week. What do you think about that?
That's cool. I like it.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hell yeah. And what are we going after this week?
The midweek session?
No, let's go the big session.
The big session? Man, that beholder sounds scary, but if it's doable, it's doable. And I'm sure there's high yield on a beholder, right?
Oh, yeah. It is. It's a major cash cow in both treasure and experience. There is one wild card variable in that.
That looks good, Walt.
My daughter's wedding is Saturday. She wanted to have it before my son is deployed. And so that, even though we had to uninvite everybody, there's still around 20 family members who will be attending. So that's Saturday. So
here is an option that I've been thinking about for you in that situation. What if we do next Friday's episode where we all use our secondary characters that you had suggested we roll up and just build them up some, so that way the main loot is still there, and that way if you need to bail, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't mess you up,
I guess. Yeah. I don't know my schedule yet, so I'm gonna say let's plan on SOP, and we'll see. You know, if I am given that 3 hours grace, I may not be, but I think right now I'm.
Well, I think you should plan to be with your family.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're doing that.
It's safer to do it that way.
Oh yeah.
And what we could do next Friday? Because do we have a guest next Friday?
Not yet.
No, that's okay. The week where they had to reschedule.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe we could do just some scouting and some sort of, you know, recon. We could recon the trolls on Friday.
Right. I could cast all the spells on you, and then if I'm not able to stay, you guys can go without me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's very doable. And the spell lasts until you break them with combat. Don't break them with combat, and you can do all you want.
Yeah.
So that's some stuff to think about. But I mean, there's still, right now, it looks like that 3 hour window is open. My schedule, I mean, so we have, actually, I'm going to subscribe. Each of you has given me a Gmail account. So I'll subscribe you to the Warp calendar, and you'll see where all our events are. So you just have a sense of my schedule.
So. And how much, well, I mean, this is something we need to talk offline, but the subscription you mentioned your guild is doing to potentially play that campaign with James.
Oh, so what we do for him is we run a couple of different events, and I call it Dinner and a Movie with Jim Ward. So it's basically $50 a session times 6 sessions. That's what we commit him to. And so each person pays $300. Really, not bad, you know, and it really helps him. So we get 6 to 8 players, and then he gets a nice infusion of a couple grand, and that's good for him.
Okay. Well, so that's, I was going to say, if it wasn't too bad, you know, maybe that's something we could make a prize, but too rich for my blood.
Well, but if someone, like, I know you said you had a friend who might be interested in joining the campaign, it is a 6-month entertainment, so it's a 4-hour.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll be passing that information on. One of our upcoming guests, sister geeked out over her getting to do this. She's like, how did you do that? I told her, I said, just tell your sister, it's because I'm famous.
Nice. Well, he does usually one to two new campaigns every 6 months. That's what I'm working him toward, just getting used to being available, because it's helpful. He does some other stuff where some different groups use him, but the cost basis isn't very proactive for him. So we're trying to find ways to supplement that to make it a better experience for him.
It's proving what Walt told me true about the gaming industry, though.
What's that?
In order to make a little bit of money at designing games, you start with a lot of money.
Oh. You have no idea. There have been several people that I've had the very big privilege to work with over the last few years, and that's one of the things that they'll say all the time. It's like, you know, you'll pour your heart and soul into a game book that just is every bit as beautiful and technically proficient with brilliant tactics so that the players can explore every kind of piece of the type of adventure that they want out of the game that you've advertised. And no matter how much you pour into it, they'll always be that, you know, just one facet that just doesn't work for somebody. And then all of a sudden people start picking it apart, and then it goes into another edition, or it, you know, people move on to something else. So this thing that you've poured maybe, you know, 1 or 2 years into developing and testing and whatever, and all of a sudden, poof, it's gone, you know, because it doesn't have the strength or capacity that something like old school D&D had, because it had these very big visionary. And I mean, you look at like some of these people who broadcast now on things like, you know, like YouTube and stuff like that, and they have the benefit of hindsight and thing, you know, like Orc Lives Matter, and, you know, the big thing, the guys who won the Ennies this year for podcasting was a group of people from who are of Asian descent, who live in Canada, that basically ripped apart the original Oriental Adventures. And, you know, looking back at that book, Oriental Adventures, and looking back at things like Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that, that atmosphere and those games taught a whole generation of people that were like, you know, just trying to figure out where they fit in the world, about what chivalry was, about what honor was. Anybody who's seen my wall in the back knows that I have two Japanese swords on my wall. Those things aren't for show. Those things cut. I mean, those are real swords that are have tested on over thousands and thousands of mats and stuff like that, and I use them for training. And it's not because I just like whacking into these mats. It's because I understand what the mat represents and what that mat represented to the culture. I mean, so like these games being looked at in hindsight, of seeing like all these people that never produced anything attack all these people that produced all this stuff, and they didn't get it all right. You know, like Oriental technically is now just a lot of people find it offensive, you know, and some of the things in that book, it was a hodgepodge, but at the same time, you know, you didn't have access to the resources you have now. You had to actually go into a library, do the research. Whether they had all the books available or not was another thing. If you could find somebody who was a technical expert, it usually was at a college, and you had to fit, you know, however many hours of interview that you needed into the time between their class schedule, you know. So like, it's crazy to see, you know, how much goes into the development of an RPG book, and how easily it can come crashing down if somebody doesn't like it. So it can almost be daunting these days to not produce one. But at the same time, I've met some amazing people through the RPG industry, people I consider close and personal friends. I consider myself lucky because of that. I've met equally interesting and productive people in the military as well. But at the same time, you know, these people who produced all of these wonderful products that spurred your imagination. I mean, for however many hours or amounts of time that you were putting into rolling these dice, you know, at some point you felt, you know, a little more than you were when you walked in. You weren't just that 14-year-old kid who had his shoes thrown up on a you know, up on a set of power lines because he couldn't speak English properly. You know, you were the paladin who defended somebody like that, and then eventually you learn to defend somebody like that. So yeah, Sergeant Hanley, nice. You either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain, right? So yeah. The role-playing games are a crapshoot, because even if you make a lot of money in the beginning, unless you're producing something with a sustainable model, you have to be able to diversify and move into other areas. You know, because like you look at I think the biggest example was second and third edition. The rules bloat in those games, it like at a point becomes unwieldy, to where it's like there were so many contradictory and mixed matched rules that at some point, you know, certain tables were just like, no, just come with the player's handbook.
Yeah, that's how we work.
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with people being unable to make the call quickly, which is a big struggle for a lot of players and DMs and GMs alike. Being able to make the call on the fly is difficult. I still find myself interrupting Jim half the time, making either a contradictory call or making the call before him. So shutting my mouth is hard, only because I'm 43 years into it as well, just on the DM side. And, you know, I it drives him crazy when I look stuff up, but, you know, that's part of being a wizard, is knowing what your area of effect is, and he, you know, remembers what he remembers, and so I always look to clarify it because I want to make sure my memory is accurate. So,
but at the same time, you're lucky in that you have that good memory and can assist in those roles, which, you know, have saved our bacon more than once.
Well, the fickle nature of this game often brings about exactly what you said. There's a lot of armchair quarterbacks. There's a lot of people interpreting it from a future point, and rule bloat, like software bloat, is very apparent in how the game is done. There are now books produced that teach, here's all the ways that your character can react. Here's all the things that your character could know. Here's all the rumors. Here's all the history. Here's where your character, instead of that being created and all the artificial stuff, there seems to be a focus and a push to answer everything. And part of the best experiences in Dungeons and Dragons is the lack of knowing and the open area adventure. And so that's
of the unknown.
Yeah.
The first module. Yeah. No, it's, you know, we're in this weird society right now where, you know, it's the everyone, and Andrew and I were talking about this offline this week or last, I forget. But it's the everybody gets a trophy thing. And like at the time, everybody at TSR, Jim and Gary and everything like that, they were so visionary. We're like, oh my gosh, this is mind blowing. And, you know, we as little kids had a tendency to say, whatever was in Dragon, you know, we devoured that, we read that, or whatever's, and we would, you know, like if you think arguing about Dungeons and Dragons rules is, try being in 1981 in a hardcore Starfleet battles group.
Oh God.
You know, like, I mean, they're, you know, trying and having a 30 ship battle and arguing over drone counters and mines and stuff like that, you know? So, but now we've entered this generation where everybody's a creator and everybody gets to have an opinion. And it's like, just like what Andrew was saying there, and I've done it too. Like I did it today to Jim, I said, hey, whatever the DM said goes. We have lost this thing in our society where people who have earned of all the people in the room playing Dungeons and Dragons, Jim Ward has earned the right to do whatever the hell he wants with it. It's his. And so if he wants to do this rules about mummy rot or whatever, he can do it. He was there at the creation of many of the rules, either as a person playtesting them or as in creating them. So, you know, Asian society has that. Oriental society has that. Screw anybody. I've been canceled. You can't cancel me twice. if you don't like that, okay, then maybe this conversation isn't for you. Go have another conversation. Get out of my business. But when a Japanese elder says something, your first response as a younger person is the words, I understand, whether you agree or disagree. Your first acknowledgement is that you have heard what they've said, but we have a generation of people who want to, you know, these are people who think that a doctorate in the pedagogy or the genealogy of the Avengers is somehow some meaningful, you know, course of study that allows them to hold forth on everything nostalgia. And it's not the case. You know, like, I think when we say like rules bloat and everything like that, if you step back and look at Dungeons and Dragons first edition AD&D second edition 3.5, what you can say is, because we were all, at the end of the day, we're all playing homebrew campaigns.
Oh yeah.
You can take whatever you want and you can use it. And that's what we do at this table. And so, like, Gary's reinforcing that point. He's like, this is not how I would run Greyhawk. This is how Gary would run Greyhawk. He's playing with a specific set of house rules. So if you want to play a game that says, when was the last time anyone played by the old racial rules where, you know, half orcs can only get to sixth level, you know, and those kind of things, you know, everybody kind of picks and chooses. But to suddenly allow this group in that's going to tell you everything that you're doing is racist, I have a spoiler for you. If they get to tell you that Oriental Adventures is racist, you're about 6 months away from all Dungeons and Dragons is racist.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've learned with that side, it's never enough. And the first time that they say anything to you, you need to verbally punch them in the face and say, shut up, this isn't for you, go somewhere else. No one cares about your opinion.
And that's the thing,
you know,
too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you should, you know, if somebody's having fun, but like, yeah, it was just like Oriental Adventures back in the day, you know, when that book came out, that was magic. I couldn't,
yeah,
I went out and investigated every culture I could find that linked back to that book. Not because I thought, you know, ooh, the Mystic Orient or something like that, but just because it was new and different and interesting. And it was, you know, even though the European history was just as interesting, I had seen that. And we had seen, you know, tons of like Greek myth, Norse myth, Arthurian myth, you know. But for a young kid who was also studying martial arts at the time, that was like, where did this come from? And wait a minute, so Japanese martial arts aren't the only, and Chinese martial arts aren't the only stuff out there. Korea has their own.
Yeah.
You know, like there were all these things that I didn't know about, like falconry and just, it was like, this is amazing. And I couldn't learn enough. And as somebody who has spent time in those countries, you know, it's amazing to see their reaction to it, and like, as you're devouring all the information they're giving you and the experiences they're giving you, not because you want to culturally appropriate them, but because of the fact that you appreciate all the hard work and dedication and stuff that you're in, what you're being shown and what you're being given, there's this sense of appreciation of you enjoying their culture versus like in the United States now, because of how entitled we've become, everybody's just like, oh, well, you're trying to appropriate their culture. And it's like, no, yeah, no, I'm not doing that. You know?
So you just roll the dice and you play and you realize we're 50-year-old men and no one cares what we do. And
yeah,
we're not
exactly
going to be on a critical role. And they go, you're a racist. And you go, great. That's the sixth time I've been called a racist today.
Well,
how many times have you been called a racist today?
Six.
One thing about Gygax to remember is that he was an incredibly curious individual, and the book was not written with an intent to harm. It was written with an intent to enjoy.
Yeah.
And so part of the struggle, and it's really how the Satanic Panic emerged in the early 80s, if you've read some of the transcripts or watched the 60 Minutes episode or any of the craziness that we lived through, and JR, this may be a little bit before your time, you know, there were ads in the newspaper. There were
the pamphlets.
Right, things delivered to your door. There were people who would speak at your school, all sorts of stuff to try and control a thing that was not understood very clearly, and then which created outrage. I remember seeing the movie Ready Player One recently, and I was so excited when that came out because I was dying for a look at Tomb of Horrors. I was dying to see what that would look like on the screen. I was so excited for that. And he skipped over the whole thing, and I remember having arguments with a lot of people because, oh, what a great movie. And I said, no, he missed the point. The idea that Spielberg is going forward on is that the cultural relevancy of the book is about how great movies were. But movies were a very supplemental piece. We've always consumed movies and gained more technical prowess and more advances, X, Y, and Z. But Dungeons and Dragons reshaped the way an entire generation and now further generations interact together and play games. The cultural revolution was not movie changes. It was really about the way in which we changed our gaming activities to create groups that could have this communal exercise together and end up in a different place and rinse, lather, and repeat. That was the significance of the book. And it is hard sometimes for people to remember what the actual function of the game is, in that anyone who has a basic understanding in mechanics can sit in on any session and they are an adventurer. They are not themselves. And in the end, all of the commentary that's going on about all the different issues that are irking people, it's a make-believe game.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing for people to swallow.
Yeah, but it's because they have make-believe problems.
Well, there is a real intent to harm. And that's not the purpose of the game. It is the exact opposite of the purpose of the game. The game unites people in ways that I can tell you, the number one piece of feedback I get from all my guilds is that this has really helped them with stress, with anxiety, with getting a chance to socialize. We use Zoom, and you know, our parties are, you know, 8 players and myself. And so we have to remember what the point is. And so I think some of the stuff that people are attacking and criticizing really misses the point of the purpose. And so, right, the only thing you can choose to do is to ignore or just say no.
You just ignore, you never apologize, and you keep doing it. And as long as there's not a corporate entity in the way, you're fine. What they will try to do is try to use, like, if you're a teacher at a school, or you're part of a corporation, the next step that they say is, oh, it would be interesting that if your employer knew that you were playing this game.
Well, show you
how insidious they are.
So I can tell you this. Yeah, that's fantastic. One of our guild masters actually runs D&D games as part of his classroom. It is fabulous.
Oh, that's awesome.
How alive his middle school class is. Can I share my screen for just a second?
Make sure to close your porn tabs.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll hold on 1 second. I'm going to do this display.
Could we capture the beholder?
So while we're waiting,
I'll put it up later.
Nick, I just want you to know that I'm so 90s that I trained in a Chuck Norris karate dojo.
Ooh, nice.
Go ahead, Weird.
Was that like an official, like, franchise?
Yeah, it was a franchise thing. They had a cardboard cutout of him when you walked in.
Oh god.
Yeah. It was a dock in the box essentially for karate.
And it was right around the time he made that movie with that kid that killed himself.
Oh, I didn't know he killed himself.
Yeah, I think the kid killed himself.
That's a shame.
Okay, so you, can you see my screen? So yep. All right. Of the stuff is up there now.
Hold on 1 second. I can share it to the Twitch stream. It just takes a little longer.
Yep, tell me when you're ready.
All right.
I took karate in the 80s with two Korean brothers who hated my guts.
All right, hold on 1 second. Yeah, we're shrinking this.
This it is wasn't karate then if it was Korean.
Tangsudo?
It was Hwarangdo.
Oh, you took Hwarangdo. The Way of Flowering Manhood.
Flowering?
Yes.
Interesting.
The Art of Curing and Killing.
So I've thrown up all the stuff. You guys can now jump in. We've obviously got to assign the longsword, and that should probably go to you, Lance, if you're not able to take it, Chrome.
Chrome can't because of his jealous lover. I mean, his sword.
Yeah.
If you want to be, is there any magic items for me?
But those are the basics. Well, so we have some open magic items. I just don't know that they're what you want. We got the gem for you, we assumed that you were okay with that.
No, I know. No, I am. I just don't get anything for it. I mean, I get to not burn, which is great. And I get to
You'll
deal with this sword that's trying to take me over.
The other thing I'm starting to do is I've been listing in each event sheet the skills. And so he's starting to put stuff in on occasion. Like in event 7, he gave 6 awards. This time he only gave me that one award for the scrying, and he didn't give Drawn one for the turning, but I keep listing a bunch of things every time so that we can get him used to the idea of it. So we'll see what comes of it. So a lot of money, some good magic, experience point numbers aren't bad.
Hell yeah. That's really cool.
That was it. So, now I see... you made a note that someone was asking about the character's backstory.
Yeah, Felix the Swift was asking what Werdna's backstory was.
So,
Werdna... He says, I'll read you his question. Speaking of Werdna, he needs a backstory. Old wizard turned young, has the memories but not the skill, question mark. So he was elaborating.
So Werdna is a Mulcahyan wizard, he was born on the Jewel River, which is near the Wizard Citadel of Fax. That's in the Whelkwood Forest, for people who know the map well. His formative years were basically exploring that area when he stumbled upon the injured dragon, and he brought it to the local druid, and the druid told him the creature's true name, which allowed him to cast Find Familiar on it, and then he brought Razor with him, and now they're able to communicate telepathically, and then they headed up through the gnarly forest and exited out by the side of Greyhawk.
Okay. Well, there you go, Felix. You have been answered. So while we've got the people, anybody else in the chat have questions?
Speak now or forever hold it so I can put my pizza away.
Oh, wow. It's almost 2. Gosh, I only have 2 hours. Yikes.
I'm sorry. So,
no big deal. We finished up late tonight anyway for campaign. So,
how'd it go?
It's
over here.
It's very interesting what they do. I like it because these are all school people plus teachers. So I have teachers and then college kids and then my youngest daughter, who's high school, but she's the highest level. So,
One of the things we could start doing, since you've got so many years of dungeon mastering experience, game mastering, maybe some of the streams that we have for the bonus streams when we have you back, we start Werdna's Schools of Dungeon Mastery or something, where you could could pass on your wisdom to new and aspiring dungeon masters.
Well, and we've talked about that, and so the club has asked me to start recording that stuff, so yeah, I'd be very happy to do that. There's lots of basic tips and tricks, plus we could talk about mechanics, and then how do you do a lot of things that are somewhat confusing. I know that the details behind the different classes. I'm trying to figure out Jim's methodology of turning, because he's making you turn each thing individually, where traditionally, according to the DM's guide, you turn a bulk number.
Yes.
And so I haven't quite figured out what the purpose of that is. And so on occasion I bring up some of that stuff, but you know, he also customizes. We got to meet an arch mummy. That was pretty cool. That was unusual. So, you know, his unique flavor is fine, but he still is also trying to do this somewhat Gygaxian. So we'll see what he wants to do there.
Hopefully my snide comment as joking around about a troll-sized mummy doesn't become reality, because everyone will hate me.
Well, they'll hate you until we're all eaten. That's the only bad news.
Well, guys, I think I'm gonna what do you call it? Shut off the lights and.
All right, guys, have we done the podcast?
I think we have done the podcast.
We have podcasted it.
So,
poor Walt, he's been podcasting his ass off all day.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, JR's been with us too. So
did he die?
No, he didn't die.
I'm here.
Walt? Did he just fade away from his? Oh, he's back. He's there. What happened to him? He's not talking.
No, you can't
hear
me?
He's lost his voice.
You can't hear me?
No, he's talking, Nick.
Oh, I can't hear him.
Oh, you must have upset James. He's listening, you know. He watches. He's booted you from the stream last week.
There's punitive damage from that. Yeah, yikes. Do we want to test out Zoom for this foray?
Yeah, it couldn't hurt. Oh, Nick went. Bye-bye.
He must have hit F5.
Oh, God. Okay.
So I can tell you probably my best day is Tuesday, if we wanted to try and do a foray. Wednesday looks really bad. Thursday, I have a small window in the early afternoon. Tuesday is my best day.
Nick is back.
So
I'm back.
Just a thought.
All right. Well, we will we'll get those details offline, and hopefully, dear listeners, you'll get to see more shenanigans. Oh, wait, wrong podcast.
Wrong podcast. Don't get weird. What's that?
I said that's impressive.
What's that? Don't get weird.
Weirdness.
Yeah. Oh, we get weird. Thanks for folks coming out tonight. If you like the Beholder, we'll post it up on the Facebook group in just a little bit, and then send us some notes. If you go to hazardstudio.net, my email address is on the front. Send me a note. Let us know what you want us to draw next, and
join the Facebook group.
Yeah, join the Facebook group. Talk to us. We'd love to hear it. And with that, we're out.